It's been well documented that US President Donald Trump has a particular appeal with male voters. Men, particularly younger men and younger Latino men, were instrumental to his return to the White House in 2024. But riding on the coattails of Trump's electoral success is a radical movement known as masculinism, led by a host of characters determined to repel the advances of feminism and reassert the primacy of men in American political life. Amongst their ambitions, the repeal of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the vote. The journalist Helen Lewis recently interviewed a number of figureheads of this movement in a piece recently published for The Atlantic. Helen, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello.
Let's start with one of the people you interviewed, Pastor Douglas Wilson. Who is he and what does he say?
Well, he is the founder, co-founder of the church of which Pete Hegseth, who is the Secretary of Defense, is a member of it. He's in a different part of the country. Douglas Wilson is based in Moscow, Idaho, so in the Pacific Northwest of America. And from there, he has built, I describe it in the piece, as a mini empire. You know, his family are involved with a local college, a local school. He's published a load of books, unbelievably large amount of books. He blogs. He has a streaming platform. And all of it is dedicated both to preaching his idea of religion, and he is a self-described Christian nationalist. He would like America to be an explicitly Protestant nation. He has described his politics as paleo-Confederate, so they have a sympathy to the Confederacy. And also he is a patriarch. I think he would describe himself as a biblical patriarch. So he believes that men should be the head of the household. You know, they should be the ones who are making the decisions, and women should very much be the kind of second tier person in that household. You know, they should be the nurturer and the supporter, but not the kind of main driving force.
Mm. So you say he has a blog. I think he's had that for about 20 years or so.
Yeah.
And sprouting his crude opinions. You say lots of books as well. How well do his books go?
I mean, it's very hard to tell because I mean, I've looked at lots of them on Kindle Unlimited. So, you know, anybody can publish on that. But he also does have a publishing house of his own, which I believe is run by his son or was in the past. So, you know, there is an appetite for this stuff in America. He was also very influential in the 90s in the homeschooling movement. So he's somebody who has thought very strategically about, you know, I have a message that I want to get out. What are all the different communication channels for me to do that? And he's been given this enormous boost in the last 6 months to a year or so because of his association with Pete Hegseth. So he went into the Pentagon in February to preach a sermon there. And what he told everybody who works in the Pentagon was that they should be unapologetic, unembarrassed Christians at work. You know, America has traditionally had this idea of separation between church and state, but he's somebody who doesn't really believe in that. He thinks that actually what would be better to be would be an explicitly Christian America.
And so how did these two come together, Doug Wilson and Pete Hegseth?
Good question. I mean, Pete Hegseth is now on wife number three after should we describe it as a turbulent past? He had some struggles with alcohol. He became a Fox News host after serving in the military, and I think was attracted to this very doctrinaire version of Christianity. You know, my sort of psychoanalytic reading of Pete Hegseth would be that he's somebody who wanted a kind of redemption narrative for himself. And so attending a very strong meat kind of church is more of a kind of personal statement about, you know, I've changed, I've moved on, than it would be to just attend a kind of very nice low-key Sunday service.
And he sends his kids to a Wilson-founded school, doesn't he?
Yeah, and that's what I mean about how Doug Wilson has really thought about. I mean, you could call it indoctrination if you're going to be pejorative about it, but he has thought about every method possible to get his vision of what America should be embedded in people's lives and to really preach that word.
Tell me about that, how he prosecutes his argument by relying on scriptures.
Well, I mean, the kind of classic canonical text is the use of St. Paul. So there's a line in St. Paul which is usually translated as the idea that godly women should be quiet. And now if you talk to historians of religion, they'll say things like, you know, that's actually about the fact that early churches were often very noisy with people sort of ululating and bickering in the way. And actually this was about saying to everybody they needed to be quiet and respectful. But it's put together with the idea that, you know, that women shouldn't preach in order to kind of come up with this vision of religion that is explicitly patriarchal. You've seen it actually in the arguments over, there's a candidate called James Tallarico who is running for the Senate in Texas. He's a seminarian. He's training to be a minister. And he had this very controversial thing he said. He's quite left-wing, where he said a couple of years ago that God was non-binary. Now, to me, I sort of slightly wince because it's kind of very progressive language and you can see why it's going to put people's backs up. But the point he was making is that, you know, God is not a human being. He exists in a realm beyond kind of mere sexual dimorphism. But this prompted an absolutely huge backlash among the American Christian right, who said, you know, God is referred to constantly in the Bible as God the Father. You know, Jesus was a man. And their vision of religious authority is explicitly male. And so that was very challenging to them.
Where's Mary in all of that?
Well, she's just somebody who, he said, you know, this is the thing. James Tallarico's idea of the need for abortion rights was that, you know, Mary was asked by God if she was willing to become pregnant. You know, there's a kind of level of consent involved in this, which, as you can imagine, also sent American MAGA Christian right-wingers around the bend as well. To use a biblical argument to defend abortion to them is fairly kryptonite too.
You say in your piece that there's always been a backlash to the advancement of women in America. How is that backlash playing out now?
Well, I think you see it very obviously on social media. You know, when the American abortion rights fell in the Dobbs decision in the Supreme Court, Nick Fuentes, who is a white nationalist influencer, tweeted something that was like, you know, your body, my choice. You know, this kind of exultant tone of the fact that women's rights in this case had been rolled back and that actually, you know, male control had been reimposed. That was the frame that he saw that decision through. You know, at the same time, in the Trump administration, as you mentioned in your intro, this is a campaign that appealed particularly to young men. The other way of saying that is it underperformed among women. And actually, there have been of all the departures from the Trump White House, it is absolutely striking how many of them have been women. I'm thinking of Tulsi Gabbard as National Security Advisor, or Kristi Noem from Homeland Security, the Labour Secretary. The turnover has been particularly high of women in this administration. So there is a kind of sense of, you know, male authority is back. And to go back to Pete Hegseth, you know, he believes that women shouldn't serve in combat roles in the military. And there have been repeated reports that he has denied promotions to female officers and actually black officers as well, in order to create his vision of what he thinks the American military should look like. And that is a male fighting force.
Yeah, and I think the latest of those promotions just came out in the past week or so. I was having a look at those and, black people, etc. Now, you and many others accept that there are legitimate concerns amongst young men in America. There's a rising loneliness, fewer steady jobs with good wages, plus social media pulling kids into dark places. There's a genuine malaise, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think we do have to talk about those structural shifts. I mean, if you look at the job market generally, there has been a creation of, you know, a diminution of traditional labouring jobs, manual labouring jobs, and the creation of more office white collar jobs. And that is a structural shift that in some ways disadvantages men. You know, men were always going to outcompete women to be, you know, bricklayers, but it's not the same when you get to, an office manager. So I think that's the kind of loss of status and opportunities. The last 20 years in the job market have been particularly tough on people who don't go to college, and actually men who don't go to college, because men are reluctant to work in things like nursing, for example. So there have been these big structural shifts that have made it quite hard for men to see what is my route to being respected and secure in life. And I think you'd see those tendencies in the UK and Australia too. And at the same time, you had this big cultural swell, particularly through the 2010s, but, you know, the kind of the future is female and we needed to champion female ambition and girls, and that masculinity is toxic. And I think all of those messages put a lot of men's backs up too. They really felt like, well, hang on a minute, things aren't actually going that great for me. So why am I being told that, you know, that I'm an oppressor, that I'm the cause of all the problems in this world? And so that's the backlash that I think that we're seeing now.
Yeah. Do you see it as a swing, as you say, in retaliation to what we had in those years past, that will somehow find a middle? Or do you think it's more dangerous than that?
I think there is always a certain level of back and forth. I write in the piece about the fact that the women's suffrage movement was opposed violently in some cases. You know, I wrote in my last book, Difficult Women, about, you know, suffragettes having cabbages thrown at their heads and being, you know, violently assaulted by police. You know, this was a movement that was very scary to people at the time, women getting the vote. And then you take it through to the 70s in America, the Equal Rights Amendment. That provoked a huge amount of backlash from people who didn't want that ratified by all the states. The same thing with campaigns against, you know, sexual harassment at work or the Me Too movement. You know, there is always a push forwards and then a swing back. But the interesting thing about it, and the reason I think that people get so exercised about feminism, is that the last 150 years have transformed the position of women. And some of that's economic, some of that's biological, some of that's about the fact that, you know, reliable birth control has put women in charge of their fertility in a way that was just, you know, unimaginable to women in the 1700s. But it's undoubtedly that the position of women compared with 1850, you know, it's just completely transformed. You would expect something like that to have some knock-on effects, I think.
And so I guess one of the differences now is that the men with these views about women are in power, unlike those men who feel like they've lost power.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we don't necessarily talk about enough, is the kind of class aspects of this. And I think that when we talk about patriarchy, I think it often works out very well for the men at the top. You know, if you look at the majority of billionaires, they're men. But if you also look at the majority of men working in, you know, really dangerous occupations like deep sea fishing, those are also dominated by men. So we need to have a slightly more sophisticated conversation about the fact that, you know, elite men are doing really well. And some, you know, and still, if you look at the heads of Hollywood studios or whatever it might be, or like politicians, those are still very male dominated pursuits. But actually, for the majority of men, the picture is much more complicated.
I like the way you say we should have a more sophisticated conversation about this and many other issues confronting the world at the moment. But that's becoming difficult in itself, isn't it? Because of what we see magnified, I guess, from on the extreme right and the extreme left.
Yeah, and one of the things that really struck me as I spoke to lots of these men who are, you know, very provocative public presences, is there's a real difference. You know, they were, some of them were, you know, very nice to me, and we had a very polite and cordial conversation, and, you know, addressing the substantive issues. And then you look at their online presence, and it is deliberately baiting, deliberately offensive, in this very calculated way. And that's because that's what the social media algorithm rewards. That's what the attention economy rewards. Somebody like Nick Fuentes has been banned from almost every social media platform, mainstream one, but he has got this system of basically getting, you know, young men to kind of clip up his videos and push them out with the most powerful message you can have on the internet, which is they don't want you to listen to this. They don't want you to read this. Mm. And so what happens, and this happens with anti-Semitism, this happens with misogyny and racism, is that having some kind of red lines is framed as the elites trying to control the conversation. It's a conspiracy against you to keep you in the dark. These things are true, but no one's allowed to say them. And that kind of conspiracist tone is just absolute catnip for internet discourse, I'm afraid.
Tell us about one of the other characters you spoke to, a man who used to write his masculinist opinions behind a pen name, Charles Cornish Dale. What can you tell us about him?
Also known as Raw Egg Nationalist, and as that name suggests, he's very into nationalism and he's very into raw eggs. So one of the ideas behind that is that you should slonk, this is the verb that they use, like a dozen raw eggs a day for protein. So he's very into eating animals. He thinks that basically vegetarianism is a kind of conspiracy by liberals to reduce men's testosterone, which is a whole other subject we could go back to. But he does one of these things that lots of these guys do, which is he mixes kind of lifestyle advice, the kind of stuff you would have once got maybe from a men's magazine, with this very hard right politics. So it's not just about, you know, it's good to go to the gym, it's good to stay in shape, it's really good for your mental health, all these kind of things. It's like in order to become a foot soldier against the kind of battery hen version of life that liberals are trying to impose on you, you have to be strong and swole and slonk all these raw eggs. And I think that's, you see that a lot across the masculinist kind of part of the internet, this kind of fusion of male lifestyle advice, male interests, male bonding, and this very hard-edged right-wing politics.
So he blames the elites for the miseries of his male followers. What does he mean by elites?
Well, I mean, the word that often gets used, and not my hymn though, is gynocracy. The idea essentially that the world has been taken over by women. You know, you've got female politicians, you've got women in universities, all of this stuff. And so there's a kind of professional class of women that are telling everybody else what to do. And for him, another big beef is just the concept of liberal democracy itself. So the emphasis on kind of individual rights and protection of the weak, to him, is sort of fundamentally anti-masculine. Because to be male and to be full of testosterone is to be dominant, you know, to be aggressive, to be a master, to be powerful. And so he has this line in his book where he says, "Is it possible to be men fully in a liberal democracy?" And that's kind of left hanging, by the way, I should say. Another feature of this movement is that people are very sometimes quite reluctant, you know, they're trolling or they're reluctant to come out and say what they think. So the actual list of prescriptions at the end of the book, one of them is, you know, get a wooden chopping board so you don't get microplastics in your food, which I was not expecting at the end of this kind of stirring denunciation of how liberal democracy is kind of, you know, is repressing men's life force. Mm. But again, you do see that sort of blended, like the serious and the silly, the trolling and the serious. And, you know, all of which is kind of calculated to appeal to people with short attention spans, as we all are now.
Yeah, exactly. Getting harder and harder to concentrate on anything more than 5 minutes. There are figures in this movement with genuine policy influence. Tell us about Scott Yanor and his relationship with Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, I mean, he is a really interesting figure. He recently joined the Heritage Foundation, which is probably the most influential MAGA think tank. They came up with this sort of suite of ideas for Trump's second term that they call Project 2025, which Trump sort of disavowed during the campaign and then has enacted quite a lot of in office. And so Scott Yanor, who's a political philosopher, again, from Idaho, joined them quite recently. And this caused quite a stink because his views, even in conservative circles, his views are considered to be quite extreme. So one of his ideas is this idea of the family wage, which is essentially affirmative action for men. The idea you should be able to hire men preferentially, pay them more, you know, all of this kind of stuff, promote them more easily, essentially to make it easier to go back to that traditional male breadwinner, female homemaker model.
Isn't that what happens anyway?
Well, I mean, yeah, I know. I was going to say, feminists have spent a lot of time saying, I think these hiring criteria might be. But the way the analysis intersects is the idea that diversity and inclusion are kind of boo words here. Mm. And that actually in the last 10 years, actually, it's been a lot of women have been as tokens promoted, right? That's key to the idea of this ideology. And, you know, that bit isn't completely ridiculous. I know lots of, you know, journalism, publishing, whatever it might be, academia, have looked around and gone, oh, my God, we're running this all male department. We really need to get some women in here. So I can see that, you know, there is that where that resentment has come from. Mm. But, you know, he was involved with Ron DeSantis, who is the Florida governor, who has this basically, he turned his state into the kind of the bulwark against diversity and inclusion. And he tried, one of the things he tried to do was get Scott Yanor appointed to a university board in Florida. And the thing that's kind of funny to me about this is that Yanor had to withdraw his application. He was too extreme for Florida. So there are still some red lines left. They're just pretty far out.
Mm, he also thinks that women were much happier in the past in domestic roles. What's their evidence of that?
Well, I mean, one of their evidence is the fact that so many people take antidepressants now. And I had this exchange with Douglas Wilson, which is that, you know, antidepressant use has massively, massively gone up in ways that I think are often quite unhelpful. I think that often people who maybe need better support in their life instead get put on pills instead. But that's something that you see throughout the history of women's health. You know, women with coming, I've just been reading about, you know, hysteria at the turn of the 19th century. And you have women who have essentially got PTSD from sexual assaults instead being kind of diagnosed with mental disorders, right? The idea that women who don't kind of fit into boxes are instead pathologized is quite an old one. But yeah, the idea is basically that feminism has taken women away from their natural role in the home and therefore made them unhappy. And that's kind of, you know, that's key to the selling the kind of tradwife lifestyle back to people, is that you would be happier if you live like this.
And I suppose we should also bring up the fact that there are some women who agree with this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I write about Helen Andrews, who wrote a very influential essay called The Great Feminization, in which she explicitly attacks the idea that, you know, universities have become more female-dominated, for example, or journalism, or the law. She thinks that having female lawyers is dangerous, you know, too many female lawyers, because they'll feel sort of too much sympathy for defendants, for example. Or that she thinks that too many women working in science is dangerous because they're not going to, investigate awkward theories that might upset people. You know, that women are too agreeable, and therefore they don't really care about the truth. They care about people's feelings. That's a really big strain in this. But obviously, also the idea of having a male protector, being able to, I think in the American context, a place with no federally mandated maternity leave, I think the idea that actually going to work is not always completely satisfying for women has quite a big appeal, because it is quite hard there to combine a job and a family. So I can see why this does appeal to women on that basis.
The movement also attracts a lot of trollers, a lot of fringe extremists, but it's also a movement with real influence. So what do you think is the future of this movement and the impact that they have on real policies?
Well, I think that the internet has become quite a hostile place for women. I'm sure lots of your listeners will have personal experiences of that. But I also think that, you know, the Trump administration rushed through in its early days a big raft of executive orders, just this sort of attempt to kind of just, you know, blast through decades of policy. Trump is now entering his lame duck era, so it's going to be harder for him to get things passed. He's obviously also preoccupied with Iran at the moment. So I think that there is all this energy around sort of stewing. And I'm really waiting to see what the next vessel that it goes into. You know, for some of these people, J.D. Vance running as Trump's successor would be the absolute ideal thing to him. You know, he's seen as somebody who is intellectually in touch with the masculinist movement. He has that very famous line, if you remember from the last election, where he said, you know, the problem with the Democrats is too many childless cat ladies, right? So Vance would be kind of their dream candidate in some ways, in the sense that, you know, I think Trump is kind of casually sexist, but I don't, how do I say this politely? I don't sense that he reads a lot of post-liberal intellectual policy papers. To put it politely.
I don't know what gives you that idea.
Right. Maybe if they did some illustrated versions, he'd be interested. But whereas J.D. Vance, you know, genuinely does. So that will be, it will be interesting to see where that goes. And, you know, the Democrats are having this conversation because the three people they put up against Trump, you know, the two women have lost and the man won. Mm. So I think there'll be a great reluctance in the Democrats to nominate a female nominee next time, just because they feel maybe that America isn't ready for a female president, which is, to me, a sort of wild thing to be thinking in 2026. We've had three female prime ministers, you've had female prime ministers, but America is still very tense about this idea of female authority in a more pronounced way, perhaps, than other Anglophone countries.
Yeah. I have noticed that. I look forward to your next piece, Helen. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Helen Lewis. You can read her piece on the masculinist movement in America in The Atlantic.